Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 234 for March 21st. Moe's still knows engines. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash, how you doing?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
First day of spring.
First day of spring.
International day of happiness.
We really had flurries. I mean, the polar vortex is
morning
gone.
Flurries. Very nice.
So no more complaining about the weather here on out until we have those horrible thunderstorms like we had last summer.
Yeah. Hey, they say a week from today it's going to be in the 60s.
Yeah.
So.
In California?
No.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Well, okay, so.
Wait. First, we got to introduce Jim McCraw, because otherwise people are going to say, who's that voice at that we're hearing here? So, journalist, colleague of ours, and freelancing all over the place, right?
Freelancing all over the place, indeed.
Okay. So we don't have to name any publication.
No, you're fine.
You're okay.
Thank
good.
You.
So anyway, back to this weather situation.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
On Sunday, I went down to Louisville with Chrysler to drive the Chrysler 200.
Mm-hmm. Was that before or after the embargo was broken?
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So we go down there in the afternoon, fly down, and it starts raining. And the rain turns to snow in Louisville, okay?
Oh, okay?
I mean, and the snow is coming down almost like here, okay? And the next morning, look out the window of the hotel and see all of the cars parked in the streets covered with snow. And so the snow stuck. It stayed below 32 for most of the day. The Chrysler people were like, uh-oh, what are we going to do? Because there were a number of people who probably hadn't driven on icy roads and two-lane.
And I take it that the tires were your standard tires, not
winter
tires.
Yeah, I mean, it was just the regular drive. And I mean, and they were, they, you know, I mean, so they had expected that this drive program would be one where the weather was very pleasant. I mean, we're in Louisville, Kentucky, for goodness sakes, and here it was snowing. They just couldn't believe it. But an interesting fact that so the Chrysler 200, their new car. I mean, it's almost such a good new car. They ought to change the name of it because people might remember the last generation 200, right? And which was a Sebring with some lipstick,
right?
That they're the only car in the segment that does offer a all-wheel drive option.
So this is smaller than the Ford Fusion? Because doesn't the Fusion have all-wheel drive? It does.
Yes.
All right. So
maybe at its price point.
Yes.
Or something. But I mean, but it is competitive, I suppose you would
Let's
say
just say
Fusion.
That very few cars of that
yes.
class offer
yes.
all-wheel
okay.
drive.
That would be a good way of putting it. But it's a really nice car that they've come up with. And you know, they're offering with two engines, V6 and I4, so they haven't gone as some in that category have gone saying, you know, we're only going to have a four-cylinder option to...
Well, that was only Hyundai, right, with the Sonata.
And didn't someone else follow them with that?
I don't think so.
Four-cylinder only?
No.
Oh, Malibu.
Yeah.
Malibu's not a V6,
how
right?
We forget.
Yeah, right.
But... No, and it's also interesting about this car is that, so, you know, when we've heard over the years of, you know, synergies and amortizing things and companies coming together and doing things, and so this car is built off of the compact U.S. wide platform, which is basically the compact wide platform that comes from Italy. The Alfa Romeo Giulietta is the... is the DNA donor for this car, as it was for the Dart and for the Cherokee.
And isn't it similar to the new little Jeep Renegade, too?
I think the Renegade is off the platform that the 500L
oh,
is
no,
off.
Oh, no, right. You're
so
right. Excuse
it's
me.
A,
right.
It's yep. a different thing. But you know, and so you say to yourself, well, you know, gee, aren't these going to be somewhat similar? I mean, you know, if you have these three cars in the same platform, and they are sharing some parts, but I mean, these are basically underbody parts, and so it'd be like, you know, the front floor stamping and the middle section stamping below. So it's you know, so it saves a lot of money in terms of engineering costs. It saves money in terms of, you know, you have one stamping plant that's chunking these things out for three vehicles, and so you're going to, you know, your tooling costs down, right? And you don't have, you know, your logistics costs down. And so presumably they can put that money in the car, and it almost seems as though...
Did they?
I think they did. I honestly think they did. And
to me, the interior looks beautiful. Now, I haven't seen it up close. I haven't driven the car.
Yeah, it drives well. But yeah, to your point, Jim, the interior... is a place where they clearly spent some dough. I mean, and
yeah, here it is up on the screen.
So, you know, the thing starts at under grand.
Sorry.
And you know, and it is really nicely executed. I mean, they did a very fine job. So I know that Ralph Gilles is going to be here next week with a 200 in the studio, so we'll actually see it.
All right.
And get, you know, an opportunity to look around it. But you know, I think that these guys have, you know, certainly raise the bar in terms of where they are in the market. Now, the question is, and I think this is the, you know, the question that they have to ask themselves, is whether this will be, you know, competitive with the Fusion, whether this will be competitive with the new Sonata that'll be coming
up. Did they go far enough?
That
when they had the chance, did they go far enough with what they had?
Right, exactly.
And Chrysler really needs to amp up its passenger car sales. I mean, their car sales are going nowhere.
Right.
I mean, really nowhere.
You can't live on Ram trucks forever and ever and SUVs, well,
yeah,
and Jeeps.
And Jeeps, and that's what's hauling the freight for the company,
sure,
right now. You know, the Dart, for whatever reason, has been a flop. It just hasn't worked.
Well, you know, but I was also looking at the numbers because I'm writing something about the Dart, and so I was looking at the sales numbers. And so the Dart is down double digit this year, but its stable mates are down double digits this year as well. So, I mean, if you look at the Charger you know, that's down. And I think the Durango is the only model that's actually up. You know, so Charger's down, Challenger's down, Dart is down.
And you saw...
They're all getting old.
Viper is not selling at all.
Yeah, so the Viper
just closed
plant
the plant.
Is, well, it next month in April, so they're going to close it down for a couple of months.
Right.
And but you know, you got to say to yourself, okay,
15 weeks is almost 4 months.
It's like mid-April to
weeks.
Mid.
Chrysler's claiming mid-June. That it's 11-week shutdown if you go by their dates. But a tooling source from the supplier industry called me and said we're shut down for 15.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, that's how we broke the story. That's how I found out about it, was a source in the supplier industry.
So the question is, how many $100,000 cars does this market able to absorb? And perhaps not,
well,
you know.
My read is that the Corvette has killed it. You know, Corvette sales are up something like almost 150%. They're running on a 34-day supply of inventory. Viper has over a 400-day supply. I think it's 412 days. And I mean that Vet.
The C7 is just, and it's less money.
Sure. Right.
Substantially
well,
less.
Well, the base
money.
Price is less. I'll bet you a transaction price, it's not that far off. Because once you order a couple of the things that you really want, you can get a C7 up to $75,000 in a heartbeat.
But the Viper starts at 88.
No, it right? starts at it starts at 99,855 or 8.
Does that include destination charges?
No. No, I mean, that's the thing. So you're basically talking $100,000 just to get into the dealership.
So you get two Vets for that, almost.
And so, I mean, even if you get one loaded up, I mean, you get one 75, you know, right. Vet for 75, you got money for gas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just,
right.
You can afford to fill the damn thing up continually. But, you know, I guess, Chrysler seems to be very optimistic, though, with the 200, because they've added, I think it's like 800 jobs to the Sterling Heights assembly plant where they're going to be building this. So, I mean, you know, one's going down, and presumably one will be going up. And,
now, the sister car to that has always been the Dodge Avenger. I haven't heard any. Are they going to do an Avenger?
Who knows?
They
don't want to talk about future programs. Come on, John.
Well, look, another source in the supplier industry told me that Chrysler was trying to figure out how to assemble Grand Cherokees in the Sterling Heights assembly plant where the 200 is made. They were trying to get another 50,000 Jeeps out of that plant.
And that would
be
why?
Complex.
And that would be because Jefferson North is maxed out. There are already three shifts. They're, you know, they can't build any more of these things, but they believe the demand is there for even more of these Jeeps.
Do you believe the demand is there for more of these Jeeps?
I wouldn't do it, even if the demand is there.
Doesn't this sort of become the slippery slope that companies begin to go down and they say, oh, gee, you know, be able to make a lot of these? Because think about it, by the time they get the thing up, unless there would be a new Grand Cherokee, how old would that Grand Cherokee be?
Well, it's got to be 4 years now, and was it just a year ago it went through a refresh? Remember, they came out, and then they did a fairly quick refresh on it, 18 months, 2 years into it. So I want to say it's got to be about a three-year-old vehicle right now.
But to go in there and re-rig the factory to make more, you don't do that for nothing. That costs money.
Well, costs money, right.
Where would you be?
And, you know, it's too bad.
I wouldn't do it. Let's just wait and see if we can get along on three shifts all the time.
Well, you know, it's the old Hollywood adage, you know, leave them wanting more. Don't build enough.
Right.
I mean, now if it's a huge gap, and 50,000 is a huge gap, you know, then you got to take a look at it. But, boy, I'd take all that money and effort and put it into making sure my passenger cars caught fire like those Jeeps have.
See, but their thinking might be, well, gee whiz, if we sell more Jeeps, we'll make more money. If we make more money, we'll be able to put it in the passenger cars. But it won't happen that way, of course.
Yeah,
but
the incremental profit would be nice to have.
Right. But then again, you know, you got to think about it is from the point of view of the customer. I mean, that if they begin to flood the market with any given product, that makes the residual value go down, and so people are not going to be happy with their car when they turn it into a new one.
It'd be interesting to look into who they're conquesting with the Grand Cherokee. The name has been out there for years. It's in its fifth or sixth iteration since the name started.
Who are they
sucking into the dealership from?
All over the map. In fact, there are people who will easily step from a Mercedes or a BMW into a Grand Cherokee. Not other Jeeps, not other Chrysler products, but the Grand Cherokee they will. It's got that good of a reputation.
Well, the SRT8's got it's one of my all-time favorites. I mean, to have all that power and torque and all-wheel drive, you get away from the stoplight first every time. No wheel spin. It's great.
You know, it's a limited production run, and so people who buy those can feel pretty confident that in the long run they'll have a car with some money at the end. And I think that's a key thing.
You know, going back to the Viper for a second, it's a shame that it's struggling sales-wise. It just did pretty good at the 12 hours of Sebring, came in second in class, and that's a huge step forward for that racing program.
And the fact that the EcoBoost engine won at Sebring is a huge step forward for Ford. I think that's really remarkable that they were able to pull it off. Ganassi Racing, I was thinking, you know, Chip Ganassi now has, like, won every major race. 500, Daytona 500, 12 hours of Sebring.
24 hours of Daytona.
Yeah. Isn't that remarkable? I mean, we all think about Penske as being the owner that does so incredibly well. And so here's Chip Ganassi, I think.
Who's got to be at least 20 years younger.
He's mid-50s. And, man, he's got all upside ahead of him. And I give that guy a lot of credit.
That's a pretty good program for Ford. Wasn't this only the second race for that engine?
Yep.
They sort of bombed out at Daytona 24 hours, but won the 12 hours of Sebring. And, very impressive. That's not easy to do.
Interesting, you know, the stuff that we'll never, ever know is what were all the considerations given and taken between Ganassi to take his BMW engines out of there and put these honeys in there, which are basically all built, as I understand it, by Roush Yates. And so who paid whom, how much?
Well, it's always about money, right? But is it also about a future eye? Could Ford be even considering getting back into Indy? Would Ganassi be laying the groundwork for something like that?
I don't know. They were supposed to have come back 3 years ago, but it didn't happen.
Well, maybe with...
But you're right. I mean, to make that radical a change, the whole power plant goes out, new power plant comes in, and in two races, you have a winner. Mm-hmm. The people at Ford Racing must have been beside themselves.
And good for them. And they're showing themselves more competitive in NASCAR this year than they were last year.
And that's where the Penske's are doing well. Because mm-hmm. Roger's hauling the freight for Ford and NASCAR.
And his three cars at the IndyCar test were the fastest three cars in the joint with those other engines from that other company. Wow. He's a true Democrat. He'll deal with just about anybody that's promising.
Gary, you had something here that you wanted to talk about, Volkswagen's diesels, too.
Yeah.
Speaking of engines.
This week that they announced that the 2015 Golf, Beetle convertible, Passat, and Jetta will get a new diesel engine, the EA288 engine. And, you know, the question is that, you know, we saw Chevy trying it with a Cruze diesel, whether that, you know, people would be interested in this. I think we've seen that Volkswagen is a company that is, you know, long going dedicated to it. In 1977, they had a diesel on the Rabbit, right? And so here we are all these years later. Now, you know, it's interesting if you look, you know, we were talking about sales earlier. I mean, you look at Volkswagen sales in the United States, they're abysmal. Rest of the world doing fairly well. And I think that by doing something like bringing a new diesel, making it available in a number of cars rather than just in a select number of vehicles, this gives them a greater opportunity to be able to distinguish themselves from the other car makers. Because, I mean, you think about it right now. I mean, I think we'd all be pretty much agreed that, you know, cars are better. You know, just the average, everyday, regular car that somebody's going to go out and buy, you know, not a Viper and not a C7. I mean, just a car, right? So, you know, what becomes the distinguishing factor, okay? So if you were looking at you know, it just always struck me that if you looked at Passat, you'd say, well, gee, do I want to buy a Passat or do I want to buy a Fusion or do I want to buy a Camry? Do I want to buy a Malibu? Or, you know, and I mean, and so what would be a distinguishing factor for that? Well, they did have the diesel in it, but they didn't make much about it. I think that, you know, by having a new diesel engine in their vehicles across the board gives them a leg up on a lot of other people. And now the cost, we don't know what that's going to be yet, and you know how it's going to
work
out with
the vehicles. Well, that's the key. If it's got the absolute latest in turbocharged diesel engine design thinking, and it gets incrementally another three on the highway, and they can put that number in their advertising saying, don't bother with Ford and Chevrolet and Dodge and those people. We have 46 miles per gallon highway.
Right.
And it's clean.
And there's, you know, it's 10 horsepower more. It'll be 150 horsepower engine, 236 pound-feet of torque. And, you know, we all know we drive torque. We don't drive horsepower. And, you know, so I think that this could be a really good advantage. Now, what's sort of interesting, though, is that, you know, Volkswagen offers a hybrid, but we don't hear very much about that.
Because it's not selling.
Well, but I mean,
it's a bomb in the marketplace. What you're saying, though, is very interesting. It hadn't hit me before. Toyota was the first one out with hybrids, really, in a serious way. I know Honda claims the Insight was first, but that was a funny little experiment that didn't work. Toyota has dominated and continues to dominate the hybrid segment. Volkswagen could do the same with hybrids. In fact, already has in the American market. You know, the Volkswagen Group, including Audi, sells more diesels in the U.S. market than any other company sells hybrids with the one exception of Toyota. So right. even though Ford's doing gangbusters with hybrids, comparatively speaking, and Honda is doing, Volkswagen outsells both of them, even though its sales are so much smaller than Ford's or Honda's in the U.S. market. So yeah, I hadn't thought of that before. They could really have already really put the flag on top of the mountain saying, we own this.
Right. But, I mean, if you really increase, because they're saying that they sold over 100,000 diesels. So this is Volkswagen and Audi. This is passenger car and SUV. Okay. And they're saying that they account for approximately 75% of diesel sales in the United States. Now, amp that up. You know, and really give them, you know, a leg up in terms of this technology, and it could be interesting to see whether they turn their fortunes around, and that, you know, when the monthly sales reports come out, that the only thing that has a plus sign next to it is the Beetle convertible.
Yeah,
who knew?
And you know, like the show that we did with this diesel water emulsion. If you can start adding water into diesel fuel, you really cut the carbon content. Mm-hmm. You really boost the fuel efficiency. If there's this. I think it's the University of Stockholm or something. Some Swedish research group is trying to figure out how to run diesels on gasoline. So, there's a lot of
you've all seen the Dizotto thing and the General Motors HCCI engine. Somewhere out there, now Hyundai's done a very similar program, but they claim
compression ignition gasoline.
Right. So somewhere out there is, in the near future, is probably the new diesel that runs on gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be a possibility. But, you know, you mentioned Toyota, and I think it would be remiss of us not to talk about, you know, big money news this week with the $1.2 billion fine that Toyota is paying for
hiding the fact that they had problems.
For hiding the fact that they had potential problems, I think that's the way they phrased it.
Well, you know, they did have problems.
Well, that's lawyer speak, isn't it?
It was the sticky, the potential sticky accelerator pedal and the floor mat problem.
Yeah.
And so the biggest fine ever paid by a corporation.
So what's GM going to get fined for hiding its defect?
More.
You think?
Well, the Toyota thing was a matter of months.
Not only more, but more because it's a U.S. domestic corporation company. And if the Justice Department, Eric Holder and all his minions, if they want to say, all right, American business, you cannot do this anymore, because if you do, it's going to cost you $5 or $6 billion. That's a very high number.
Yeah. My guess is GM will not pay that big of a fine. And the only reason I say that is the Justice Department alleges that Toyota deliberately misled, deliberately tried to hide this, whereas the GM thing, and we don't know all the facts yet, it looks like this is just bureaucracy and red tape run amok, and nobody even inside GM knew what was going on. We'll see if that's really the case or not. But,
right.
but if that's the case, then they were not misleading NHTSA or the Justice Department. They'll still get fined. Mm. But I don't think necessarily it's going to be as big a fine.
And we were talking earlier about the whole, you know, who was in charge then, what did they know, and when did they know it? Mm-hmm. And we've been through how many administrations at General Motors in 10 years?
Yeah, that'll be a problem.
Buck passing, you know, losing the file, who knows?
And Dr. Nick just came in and said on the chat room that you're a little optimistic, John. So I think he's referring to that. Okay, so what do you guys make of the fact that this week they announced that they were going to have a guy who would be in charge of
the safety.
And so here's a guy who is a 40-year vet of General Motors.
Started as a co-op student.
Right.
In the 70s.
So is that the right move to have?
Yes. Yeah,
to have
and I'll tell you
as
why.
As opposed to getting a safety czar from, say, Stanford or the federal government?
Or Boeing or Caterpillar or Cummins or Lockheed Martin or NASA or...
Okay.
Well, I think it's a good move because one of the reasons why Toyota had to pay this big fine was it hid the stuff and obfuscated and whatnot. But what really came out was that top management at Toyota really didn't know a lot of what was going on. So here's GM being very proactive, borrowing some of the very moves that Toyota, after everything blew up in its face, was forced to take. So here's GM coming out and saying, we've got a safety czar. Here's somebody who knows the company inside out and backwards. I mean, this guy's had every engineering assignment practically there is in the company. And he's going to be making, they made a big point about this, regular and frequent reports to top management and even the board of directors. And the Justice Department and NHTSA, they're going to love seeing things like that, that GM is taking this very seriously. It's not waiting for outsiders to tell it, you have to do this, this, and this.
Well,
it's doing it on its own.
I hope that this is a hallmark of the Barra-Royce administration. It only took them a matter of days, rather than having meetings and let's consult the board and just letting it string out. They just said, okay, safety czar. Days, literally days, and only, what, 2 weeks after the 3 weeks after the appointments? Mm-hmm. This is the new administration, and the signal couldn't have been made more clear.
Yeah, but I get back to the thing.
These are the new people running General Motors, and we're going to fix this.
It's new people, but it's of the culture where the problem arose. Okay? And this is why I think that somebody from the outside who would have engineering skills, who would have engineering know-how, who would have engineering talent, who didn't come up from the system, would then be looking at this, and you would have, I mean, because presumably, I mean, you've had all these engineering jobs. Where was the problem that is being addressed? Wasn't it in engineering?
That's hard to say yet.
Well,
and the reason I say that is
purchasing.
I'm not even sure it was that. Because, look, we know that the engineers caught this defect right from the get-go. They caught it in 2001. In no time at all, they had a fix for this. And it went through reviews and studies and reappraisals, and nothing ever happened with it. But this could have been fixed a long time ago, and nobody would have ever known that there was a problem. So
I'm still for the outsider.
Yeah.
I'm still for the outsider.
There's lots of merit in what you say. Bring somebody in who has no vested interest, no pension coming in a few years, and say, fix this. Talk to anybody and everybody you want as often as you want, but fix it fast.
One of our journalistic colleagues yesterday suggested to me that maybe this guy is going to be like a pinata, that they're going to put him out there and let him get hit with a stick, and you know, then in a couple of years he'll be retiring. I mean, because you know, if he's worked there for 40 years, I mean, geez.
It's a long time.
He's got to be ready to retire, right? And so I'm just like,
I don't know. The media scrutiny has to play some part in this. They have, you know, putting the feet to the fire on every talk show that there is, and this is going to affect the stock price. And when you say stock price, suddenly it's on CNBC, and it just keeps
right. So VRM Chris says it's the management, it's not the engineers, and so I think that
I would agree.
There's
with
agreement
that.
I agree with him.
Yeah.
And so we'll see, because doesn't the CEO of General Motors work there a long time?
Hey, why don't we get to the next part of the show? Because I'm just itching to talk about these Ford racing engines from way back when, all through the decades and whatnot. So. Ben, why don't we take a quick break here, and we'll get Mose Nolan back on the show right after this.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree. Every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Okay, we've just done an Insta poll with the live chat audience here to find out, should General Motors, per Gary's suggestion, have hired an outsider, or is it okay to use somebody inside the company who's intimately knowledgeable with all aspects of the company?
So this just goes to the point of how smart the audience of this show is.
I see.
Because they agree with you.
64% said General Motors should have hired an outside safety czar. 36% said no. So for the 36%, rethink your position. Just come to the right side.
Good going.
Are we
going to
re-poll at the end and see if it went up or down? Okay.
They may not, I mean, at the end of the show, they may not like me, and so they'll go way down.
So let's let the audience know. We now have Mose Nolan back here on AutoLine After Hours. You were with us last year. It was a fantastic show. Welcome back.
Okay. How many years, Mose, start to finish? At
57.
57 years.
57 joyful years, yes. Because of most of it, 35 or better, was spent racing. And you know, Jim, that's always exciting. And the people are exciting.
Indeed.
Yeah. So how did you get that gig?
Well, I come back from the service and was assembling experimental engines, just production car engines. And I like to pay a lot of detail, attention to detail, you know, and I would make the engineering side comfortable by showing them burrs and rough surfaces. And so anyway, they thought that it took that kind of attention and skill to build race engines. So one day our chief engineer Bill Gake sent for me and asked me if I wanted to join the race group because we were going to go do some serious racing. He says, but remember, 6 to 7 days a week, no sore throats, haircuts only on Sunday. We want you here. Okay, so I volunteered to do that because I thought it was going to be exciting. And it was. It's been a terrific ride for me. About, like I say, 35 years of Indianapolis, Le Mans.
Do you miss it? I mean, you heard us talking earlier about Chip Ganassi winning the 12 Hours of Sebring with the EcoBoost engine.
I do miss it. I miss the people. I miss all the friends that I would see on a regular basis on weekends and so on. And always happy to bring good news back to management. Not happy to come back with excuses, but that happened too, you know.
What was the very first race engine program you were on?
Was
it a 427 side oiler?
It was a 427 side oiler, and I attended in 1961. I attended the Milwaukee Mile. Was the first race I attended representing Ford and making recommendations to the team.
And that's IndyCars?
I'm sorry? No, that was USAC NASCAR.
USAC?
Yeah.
Because I only know the Milwaukee Mile for the IndyCars that were there.
Yeah, true. But no, we had the Paul Goldsmiths and the Weatherleys and the, you know, so on. It was great. It was very exciting for me, and I thought, geez, I hope I can hang on to this horse for a while because it was great. Yeah.
And you had support all the way up to the very top of the company, that there was this desire to go out there officially with the blue oval and say, we race. We race every weekend. It's good for the product. It's good for sales on Monday.
That's
true. And it just kind of came down, and there were not, it was not like there were five people. There was a pretty substantial group as it grew in the early 60s, yes?
That's true. There was. Our powertrain group was, at that time, was about 9 members, I think, under the direction of Bill Gay and Bill Ennis and Joe McCura. And it was a small group, but I was given quickly responsibilities that I thought maybe I was in over my head, but apparently I satisfied them because it just went on and on. And of course, we all know about Mr. Ford stopped racing in 1970. But in 1980, when they decided, when Michael Kranfuss come to town and started the department up again, and we were going above board for racing, then they come and located me. And at that time, I was working for Fran Hernandez out here in Livonia. And I was happy to get the call.
So when you first started, I mean, what was involved? What were your activities? You'd go to work and do what?
Well, originally it was to assemble race engines, all right, fine detail, and then follow them to dynamometer, do some top-end tuning on them, and so on. And then the pace got to where other people would work with me and were trained and so on, and then they decided they needed an overall coordinator to sign off inspection sheets and go to the track and make recommendations for the team to make sure they were setting up right and so on. And then it went right on into advance into modifying parts and making pieces and so on and redesigning. And it just grew right into it. And I got the call for Le Mans in 1966. Well, the first call came for Indianapolis in 63, if you recall. That was very exciting. So I was at Indianapolis in 63 and 64 and shortly a few days in 65. But then come the Le Mans program, which we really got serious because Mr. Ford wanted that one.
Okay, but 63 and 64, let's not leave that because, I mean, that was 63 Jimmy Clark or was it 64?
63 was Jimmy Clark and Dan Gurney in a pushrod.
Yeah, we got a picture of the car, I think, up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's the 63 that Jimmy Clark, well, that's a Dan Gurney car there, and that was race day, and that car was being pitted by part of John Holman's group and part of the Lotus people and so on. The next year, they brought in the Woods Brothers and really
showed everybody how it's done.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a
lot of. What was it like working with Colin Chapman? I mean, this guy's one of the vaunted names of motor racing.
Yeah. Colin Chapman was great, and he paid a lot of attention to detail, and he had his principles of how a race car should be built, you know, and so on. I have a little story about installing a set of Weber carburetors on that 63 model, and of course the housings were made of magnesium, you know, and very delicate, and a good mechanic won't screw a nut down on the magnesium. They put it down on a SAE flat washer, you know. Well, I was sprinkling these washers over the studs and starting. Mr. Chapman come along and he says, "Lad, what are you doing?" And I says, "Installing carburetors." He says, no, those washers, get them off of there. They're too heavy." And I'm going like, wow, you know, I guess I better pay attention here. I know what the theme is now, you know.
Right. Lightweight.
Nothing extra, you know.
This is one of the great racing axioms of all time. If you take your part and you throw it up in the air and it comes down, it's too heavy.
Too heavy.
Well, and Chapman's ideal race car would break down the instant it took the checkered flag, right? I mean, that's what everyone said about him.
John, there was nothing there to spare. He had it programmed, and if I recall, he kept bragging about a 17% safety factor, and that was all. And 17% would get you to the maybe to the end of 500 miles, and he lucked out pretty well, yeah.
520, maybe
yeah.
Not.
True.
Well, you know, obviously his theories worked. I mean, he's still one of the most successful managers of race teams of all time.
Absolutely, he was. But, I mean, he lived and breathed his race cars. I don't know who took care of the production side of it. It certainly wasn't him, because he was with Jimmy Clark and 24 hours a day, you know. It was interesting how that got started, you know. In 62, Ford had this Mustang One concept car up at Watkins Glen, and Dan Gurney took it for a few laps around the track. And that's when the relationship built, because, you know, Gurney had eyeballed these monocoque lightweights that the Lotus people had put out. Colin Chapman specifically designed the Lotus 25. He just, and Gurney just went, how about the small block Ford in one of these, you know? Of course, that particular race for the Formula car was powered by a Climax, a 212-horsepower engine. Of course, Gurney saw 350-plus, you know, going in that thing, and he actually brought the two together, and it was very interesting how that come about. Mr. Chapman was going to leave Watkin Glen. Their next race was Montreal, and of course, he really didn't want to return back to England for the prepping, you know, so Ford says, well, come to Dearborn. We'll give you a stall and a couple helpers, and you can do all your prepping there. Meantime, we can photograph and weigh and measure and so on. So when that car came to Dearborn the day after Watkin Glen, I got the call to work with them. So, and that's when things really cemented in, you know, and so on. And I traveled with all the test trips that we worked with. Had a couple other fellows we trained that there's pictures of us installing engines the 1st of May at Indianapolis in the old barn door type garages, you know, and it was just so interesting. There we are, right there. And OSHA wouldn't approve that harness there. They sir, would they? Huh? But
no,
that was my
glasses. No, none.
No, none. That's my partner, Charlie Nine. He and I worked together probably for 2 years just on that program. You know? But
and didn't you go from the relatively straightforward pushrod program to the gigantic four-cam, four-valve Calliope engine with the exhaust coming out the center?
We did. And actually, 63 with the pushrod engine was like sort of a dry run. Let's go down and see what this is all about, you know. And we got a lot of attention there, and we nearly had the race. But our driver couldn't pass the leading car, which he was capable of doing because of the oil leaks, you know, and the car was skittish and his goggles were fogged over, you know, and so on. And they wouldn't black flag Parnelli, so we had to settle for second. Yeah.
You know, one of our viewers, JM1NB, wants to know, and I'm thinking about this in the context of the washers, and what is the most difficult problem that you faced in developing these engines that had the easiest fix?
Well, we had, in that pushrod engine, we had, for some reason, we had a lot of thrust on the cam thrust plate. And I lived very close to engineering and was really acquainted with our machine shop fellows and so on. Well, we got a call late in the evening, 7, 8 o'clock, that we were breaking thrust plates, and of course they were cast regular production thrust plates. So I went over to the machine shop and we got a hold of some 4130 and put it on a Blanchard grinder and ground them and took them over, you know. And I think that was one of my best contributions for that. And really, I wasn't an engineer on a job. I was nothing more than a coordinator, but something had to be done. And my theory is do something, even if it's wrong, you know, just do it, you know. And we were back running before morning and stuff like that.
Good theory.
Yep.
What was the difference between a Dan Gurney and a Jimmy Clark in dealing with them from your vantage point?
Well, they were both gentlemen and excellent to work with, and they would answer your questions, you know, and they no caste system whatsoever. They respected you. And I think the difference was that Jimmy Clark, with his Formula One racing experiences, he was smooth as silk, you know. And of course, Dan was an excellent driver also. But I would say that at that time, Jimmy Clark got acquainted with the car a little bit quicker than Dan did. And in 1963, if you recall, Dan got into the wall at the very last practice session, and we worked all night to bring the mule up and switch engines and weld up headers and stuff like that. But Jimmy Clark was right there beside him to keep him calm down and say, hey, you know, just cut it a little tighter in the turns, you know.
Mose, wouldn't you say, though, that a major difference, Jimmy Clark was a pure driver, and he could come back into the pits and say, it's doing this and it's doing that. And while Dan could do the same thing, Dan went on to create the Gurney Westlake engine and any number of car designs that were successful in all kinds of places. And, you know, he could jump. I don't picture Jimmy Clark ever jumping into a 63 Ford and going to Riverside and winning the race.
That's true, Jim.
He was very focused and very narrow.
Even though earlier in his career he had done others. Yeah.
There was a marked difference between the two fellas. Jim Clark was a fine driver. I mean, one of the world's best at the time. Dan Gurney was an excellent driver also, and engineer, slash engineer.
Yeah.
So when Jim had come in and he had a problem he wanted to discuss and resolve it, he would tell you what the car's doing. Dan had come in, tell you what it is, and make recommendations.
It was
a pleasant atmosphere to work with him, and it built your confidence too that hey, we're going to get through this mayhem, whatever it is, you know.
So with your long history in dealing with drivers of various types and various levels of skill, I mean, what did you see as being the factors that would create champions?
Well, I guess I'd have to say that it all depends on what kind of race you're in. You know, whether you're in one of these lightweight Indy cars or whether you're in a real mule like a early NASCAR that didn't have power steering or anything like that. But I would say that there was a distinct difference between them. And we've tried to bring Indianapolis into NASCAR, and we tried to bring NASCAR into Indy, and it just, to me, didn't seem to really take off or produce any instant conversions, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think they both had their skills, and they both had their bravado to take chances. Mm-hmm. And the NASCAR boys didn't mind rubbing on each other either to get it. You wouldn't do that with an open wheel car, you know. So.
You've been in all different kinds of racing, mm-hmm. or involved in building engines for all different kinds of racing. Any one particular that is your favorite?
Actually, Indy and Le Mans, I would say Le Mans is my favorite because we had the direct attention of Mr. Ford. He wanted that race, and we had no problem getting tooling. We had no problem getting supplies. We had no problem getting parts modified. I mean, I feel that was the greatest heyday for Mose right there. Mm-hmm. And then to be asked to go over and tune the cars, that was, you know, that was the payday right there. Not only once, but twice, 66 and 67. And in 1966, Gus Gussel, our director at that time, said that, well, we got a small group here of nine guys, and half of them's going to go in 66, and I'll assure you that's left behind. You'll go next year. And I was the only one that went both years. So,
you had some, as part of that massive effort, you had some new characters on the scene, namely guys like Carroll Shelby and Phil Remington and guys. Was that just a complete hoot for you? Because you're from here, and they're Californians and Texans. Did that...
To me, at first, when I saw this coming together, it was a little bit intimidating because you wonder whether you can cut the mustard at all or not. But both of them real gentlemen. I tell you, I have so much respect for Phil Remington and his engineering on the spot, fix it type thing, and his confidence in me. I know that we had an incident when I had to leave the Holman shop. about 4 p.m. and boarded a plane from Charlotte to Los Angeles because of a little problem prior to 67. And Phil was right there with me all night, and just, you know, he says, well, you're the man. You know what the engine requires. He says, I'm here to, you know, satisfy your needs. So, excellent man. He certainly helped the Le Mans program with that quick change brake pad thing that he engineered. That was, he didn't have to pull any hubs or rotors.
Absolutely brilliant,
brilliant
fabricator.
Man.
I don't think there'll ever be anybody as good as Phil Remington. Yeah. He was fabulous.
Yeah. Hey, we've got a lot of questions coming in here. I think it's, we got to get to the rapid fire part of the show here because they're just pouring in. So, Ben, let's run it. Okay, Mo's Jumpy Joe wants to know, did you ever get to look at Mickey Thompson's mystery Ford 427 Hemi with three-piece push rods? What'd you think?
Well, tell you the truth, I never actually saw it because in those days, you know, when an owner or a builder had something that he was so proud of, you know, the fender blankets went over it. You didn't see it. I heard about it, but I never did see the piece to see what the concept was. But I heard a lot about it.
What would you do with a three-piece push rod?
Well, the only way I'd ever think of a 3B push rod, a three-piece, would be a tube, press in two ends. There's your three pieces. But it wasn't that. It was not that.
Very interesting. Okay, Mark Beckman or Bachman says, what would you say is the most significant engine that you worked on, and what challenges were there that made it successful?
I would say the 427 side-oiler Le Mans engine. And the reason for that, Mark, is we had some pretty good material in these various parts. And the surface finishes on them was important and was there for longevity. Now, the engine horsepower, if you probably know this, it was a NASCAR engine detuned to go 24 hours. And I believe in 24 hours we made 3,251 some miles travel.
Right down to the last digit, 3,251. Good for you.
so anyway, that was the most interesting engine for me because we were so dependent on bringing this thing home as a winner for Mr. Ford, you know.
Yeah. Carl Esposito has a very similar question. I don't know, maybe it's a little bit different. What would you consider the pinnacle of engine design? Same one, or?
No, I would have to vote for the Indy Camber engine because of the deviation between push rods to followers, the cup-type follower and so on, and four valves in the pin chamber, combustion chamber, and the dual overhead cams with, I believe it was 16 or 17 straight-cut gears in the front that drove this whole thing. That was the one you really had to pay attention with. It. You had the proper clearance on all these. They were noisier than all get out. I mean, when that thing come around turn four, it was screaming, but it was all these gears rattling, you know. It certainly wasn't the air slipping off the car. But I thought that was maybe the most complicated engine that I was connected with in our racing programs.
Hmm. Jim Campbell wants to know if you ever worked with Carroll Shelby on the GT40 at the 24 Hours of Le Mans.
Yes, Jim, I did, and I truly respected that man. He was with us in 66 and 67 at Le Mans and made his rounds regularly and asked your opinion on engine condition. See, every evening during the practice session, it was my job to go around and do leak down tests on it and so on and relash the valves and things like that. So we had direct contact with Carroll, and I really respect the man.
Hey, we've got a number of phone calls here. Ben, let's bring in one of them.
Yes, this is Joe Torregrossa calling. Regards to Tesla, I'm just curious to know what your opinions would be as as far as how they're going to resolve the law of the dealerships, where certain states are stopping them from actually selling the cars directly. And why? Why is there such a problem with that? Joe Torregrosso, I'm in Tamarind, Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Tesla's got a major fight on its hands. It's trying to fight the franchise laws in this country. It's going to have a tough time with it. I don't want to get into the whole history of it, but the National Auto Dealers Association was formed in 1953, the NADA, to protect dealers against the factories, because the dealers had made all these investments in their dealerships and whatnot, and it was not uncommon at the time. If the factory had a bunch of unsold cars, they'd go into markets, rent a warehouse, and just blow them out at discount prices that the dealers could not compete with. And so the dealers went, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't like the way this is going. And so they formed the NADA, and they went through all 50 states, one at a time, getting legislation passed that protected the franchise system. They were very smart in not getting a national law, because if the national law is overturned, it affects all 50.
Everybody, yeah.
So Tesla now has to fight in every one of the 50 states. It's going to be an uphill battle. Car dealers are extremely well politically connected, and lots of luck, Elon. This is going to be one hell of a fight.
But it won't be a 50-state fight, because he has no interest, I'm sure, in selling cars in Alaska, because he'd probably sell, what, five? Yeah. You know what I mean?
And or Wyoming.
So,
right.
Yeah, so there are lots of states.
But he's going to fight every state he wants to sell in.
Right.
He will have a fight on his hands. I've been asked, because I've been interviewed about this by the media in California, why can he do this in California? And I said, just wait. The California dealers are the next ones after him, too. I mean, and I admire Elon and what he's trying to do. My bet is he will not be successful in fighting the franchise laws.
So that means RIP Tesla Motors?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means that there will be a little bit of funny business. You'll go into a showroom, will not be a dealership. You will do all your research and blah, 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 and then you're going to have to get online and buy it from the factory. And then it's going to have to be trailered across the country to you. So, which is how it's essentially being done right now. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the key reasons why Tesla wants to start selling cars outside of the United States. Although,
no China, franchise laws.
China has pretty much adopted the U.S. franchise distribution system. So it's going to be interesting to see how this fight all goes.
All right. I have a powertrain question. So yesterday, General Motors showed us they have a variety of new small engines. And so they took us and they showed us their dyno lab. And to see all of this equipment that they're testing engines with, and they have this one setup where you're actually able to take the engine and move it and to see, you know, how the oil is going to be. Now, I got to believe when you were, you know, back in the 60s doing this, how did you do that sort of testing?
Well, I believe a test like that would be done on a track. And it was track testing that gave us the trapdoor oil pans. You're familiar with the bustle pan, and it had the trapdoors in them where the
every race engine for years on end had an oil pickup that was built and never moved. They discovered that if you have these trapdoors in the pan and a pickup that swings with gravity, you never uncover the pickup. It never sucks air. It's always in the oil.
True. Mm-hmm. But you just had to take it onto the track, test it, and then tear the engine apart to see?
And look at bearing conditions and so on, yeah. and get driver's reports of spiking and failure of oil pressure on the gauge and so on.
And then you'd have to quickly fabricate parts in some cases?
Yeah, the next time out, you'd make a change, and you'd either weight the flaps a little more, or maybe lighten them up, or move them a little bit, and so on, to keep the oil from washing up. There was two things that happened with oil that sloshed to the side. It would get up into the counterweights of the crank and stay airborne momentarily, you know, till the car leveled out. And that was a risky period of starvation at the time, yeah.
So they invented the windage tray to keep all that stuff where mm-hmm. it belonged.
And so that was just purely a racing
keep
development.
Keep the oil
you guys.
Off the yeah. crank. It drags yeah. on the crank.
It was a look-and-see piece of business at that time. Mm-hmm.
I love the show. I'm always learning things.
Well, it's a great place to meet and trade ideas. I mean, there isn't anything being done today that wasn't done years ago, except with the new test equipment and servos and the elaborate, very elaborate test cells that they have today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, Ben, we've got more phone calls. Let's bring in another.
Yes, it's Jim calling from Calgary. Just wanted to congratulate your guests, or Ford, on their finish at the 12 hours of Sebring. And nice to see Ford back into racing. Will we start to see them more, I guess, more and more into racing and maybe see the likes of the Ford GT and stuff maybe back in from Ford Racing. Thank you very much.
Yeah, what do you think? Will Ford get more involved in racing?
I think that we never quit shopping because it is our marketing tool. And the boys are doing some fantastic development right now. Of course, you know, we have this alliance with the Roush Yates engine building, which is a real, you might say, facilitized skunk works, and they're doing very well with their product right now. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw Jim Farley being interviewed at the 12 Hours of Sebring, and he said something that I can't remember what it was, but it sounded to me like he was strongly hinting some big announcements out there. And I couldn't tell, was it Indy, was it Formula One, was it Le Mans? I don't know. But he was strongly hinting something else was coming.
Well, I would, if I were a betting man, I would think maybe Indy is much more important to American car sales than
Ford,
F1.
It's one Ford, it's global, you know? So if you're going to spend a bunch of money, do you want to...
Did you see the first race of the season with the 1.6-liter engine that went zzz, and everybody hates it?
The F1 race.
No.
So, Mose, did you see technology developments that you guys did make their way to production cars?
We did. It was one of the, especially in the second round of Ford Racing that began in 80, 81, we were chartered to report advancements in materials and finishes and fits and finishes and so on. And there has been, quote a number of things that went over to the production side, but that was part of our charter was to discover improvements in components and announce it to the product development people.
Yeah. And the biggest single change in that period was that they started to sell parts. And if the parts broke, you'd have very angry racers. So there was a lot more R&D. If you were going to build a race crank, it had better be forged steel with all the right machining done to it. You send it to a drag racer and he breaks it in half in one race, he's going to be very upset. So everything that had the Ford oval cast into it or stamped on it was tested by these guys.
Yeah. You know, one of our biggest contributions and validation in racing was compacted graphite iron for cylinder blocks and main bearing caps and things like that. That got carried over into our truck programs early years.
Hey, we've got more phone calls. Ben, let's bring one in.
Hey, guys. This is Youngblood calling Cleveland, Ohio.
All right.
Great show. My question is for Mr. Noland. And the question is which race driver, any series, in your opinion, live life to the fullest, both on the track and off the track? And is there any story about him that you can spill the beans on?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Thank you. Later. Bye.
Yeah. Which race driver that you dealt with do you think lived life to the fullest, both on the track and off?
How much time we got? Well,
because you lived in an era.
I would have to say that it was in the early days, Joe Weatherly and Roberts.
Fireball?
Fireball Roberts. They were a couple tough cookies that that caused a lot of excitement off the track as well as on the track.
And, what about Pops?
Yeah, Pops was...
Who's Pops?
Curtis Turner.
Curtis Turner was my reserve man. He was just... You know, I've seen Curtis on race day at Daytona come in, and of course, wingtip shoes, you know, and shirt out and so on, and it apparently had a terrible night before because he was in the Firestone Tire reception area in this wicker chair laid over like this, and they had to shake him and wake him to go out and make grid time with his car, you know. So they were not celebrities. They just lived their style.
So they got it. So they'd have a big night, and the next day they'd get in the car and race?
Get in the car and race, you know, and I'm not even sure that they buckle up their safety belt, you know.
I saw this man
no
in action
suits.
Myself. There was a famous racing driver dinner hangout in Daytona called Roberts. He's smiling.
Yeah.
He's been there.
Yeah.
Curtis Turner walked into that place the night before the race with a blonde on one arm and a brunette on the other arm. And he pulled his shot glass out of his jacket and said, "All right, boys, there's going to be a brand new party starting in about 15 minutes. That was Curtis Turner. He was one of the earliest guys to fly himself from race to race. He was a licensed pilot, and that's what killed him in the end. He died in a plane crash. But the boy knew how to party.
Yeah, there was a story about Fireball, and I believe it was Fireball, but definitely was Curtis Turner. They were flying and decided that they needed a drink, and as the story goes, they put the single engine down on some little Berg's Main Street and was looking for liquor. I can picture that in my mind as happening. I can picture it that, yes, that's Fireball, but, you know, I heard the story several times, and I'd really like to know if it was true or not. But
but it rings true.
Yeah, it was too good not to be true.
Mm. It's interesting. Now you see those spots during NASCAR races where they're showing the drivers all exercising and, you know, riding bikes and treadmills and doing all this, and these guys are out living it up.
Yeah, Gary, it's so different now. I mean, the race drivers of today are professionals. They come in on Sunday morning and they're all been through their massages and therapies and their gymnasium and so on, and climb in the car and go. And even the pit crew, you know, the pit crew years ago used to be shop personnel. You know, who knew the car better? Today, it's hired athletes that do nothing but fly in for Sunday morning, Saturday or Sunday, and do the pit stops. Of course, you see some fantastic pit times now, you know.
It's unreal. But, yeah. You know, when you see some of the Formula One pit stops under 3 seconds, it's staggering.
Yeah.
It is, but you know, in this last Formula race, I was watching it Sunday, and I couldn't believe how many over the wall. I counted 12.
Yeah, three per tire, and one in the front and one in the rear.
Yeah. Well, we were held to five for a long time, you know.
Yeah, no, it's a different situation in Formula One. Got another question here from Bob Longmate in New York, who says, during your stellar 57-year career with Ford, did you ever imagine that a Ford racing engine would be purpose-built with 70% production parts, as with the 3.5-liter EcoBoost Daytona prototype winner at last week's 12 Hours of Sebring?
Their answer is no. I never never believed it. But I'll tell you, you look at this engine naked, and it is so delicate looking and so lightly, lacy, really, to me, compared to what I'm exposed to. And no way in heck is this thing going to pop the horsepower that it's making and last as long as it does. But see, That's the advantage of materials that's been developed through the years, and a lot of it coming from the aircraft industry. And, of course, our fantastic machining capability now for dimensional control. And you put all that together and our super, you know, synthetic fuels and lubricants, it'll do the job.
That's a great point because, you know, when I was a kid growing up watching racing, down to the last lap, if somebody had dominated the race, you still didn't know if he was going to get to the finish line.
Right.
There was such a good chance that that car would break down. And, boy, today they just don't break down.
Well, I'll tell you what, they
You're
are...
not talking about Darrell Waltrip by any chance, are you? Who managed several times to scatter his engine as it went under the checkered flag. So what was there left to inspect?
Right. Well, you know...
Pieces, junk. Smelly, stinky.
Talk about the robustness of today's engine, especially the NASCAR guys. Just picture that burnout after a victory.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, here this thing is over 10,000, 11,000 RPM, smoking the tires, and he does that for a minute and a half or so on. That was reserved for the winning the race. I mean, the engine held together for that. He probably had a good safety factor in durability, without a doubt. But yes, they used to grenade the engine so that it couldn't bear any hidden secrets. Jim, you've been around this quite a bit.
I have indeed.
Yeah. Okay, we got some more phone calls. Ben, let's bring in the next.
Yeah, hi, John. Ernie Brink from Barrington, Illinois.
All right.
Just was curious on Moses' opinion on the rotary engine back in the 60s and 70s. Bye.
Yeah, Ernie Brink is a friend of ours. He's really into rotary engines. What do you think of them?
Well, I believe if that was today, Ernie, the materials that we have today and the precision machining we have today, that we'd have made the grade. But I was supervisor of the rotary engine experimental department assembling those things, and it was kind of tough to try and make progress week after week, and we just couldn't master the apex seals in the rotors. They just wouldn't hold back the oil and so on, so our emissions were terrible. Personally, myself, I thought it was to our advantage when Mr. Cole of General Motors decided to scrap their program, and then we turned around and followed suit. But I think today the rotary engine would stand a good chance of becoming popular, durable, and very serviceable.
A.M. Guerrero wants to know, which modern engines do you find the most interesting?
Well, right now I'm very curious of this Ford EcoBoost. You know, I recall when we started playing around with turbochargers, you know, and it's a very, very severe environment a turbocharger works in and so on. And we passed through the varnishing up and the stalling of the charger and so on. But this EcoBoost uses two little bitty turbochargers, and I just can't imagine those things spinning the speed that they are and putting the pressure on this little engine. So to me, that's a fascinating engine, and of course it's in my book, is in its infancy, but it looks like it's standing up to the call.
And as you said earlier, you have much tighter precision tolerances in all the parts of the turbo, and you have synthetic lubricants, and you have water-cooled bearings now that you didn't have in the SVO
True.
Car in 1984.
True. I mean, it was very common back in the early Turbo J's in SVO. You shut the engine off and go back out an hour later, and the turbo was seized.
Yeah.
Then what we did to overcome that, the ignition was designed to where it ran a cool down. Well, then the next step was to circulate oil into the turbocharger for 6-8 minutes after the car shut off and so on. And of course, come along the improvements in lubricants and so on, and we got over the hump. But they weren't too trustworthy to start with. They were fine performers, when you wound them up and left them there. Yeah, when you stop, you wonder about the next go.
Dave Morris says that he went to a lot of Trans Am races when you worked with Bud Moore. And he says, Bud Moore thought very highly of you, at least based on his book, Man and Machine. And he just wants to know, do you got anything to say about Bud Moore?
I love Bud Moore. He is one of the legends, and of course I really respect him because of his contribution to the United States Army and so on. You know, he's many medal winner and so on. And Bud and I used to have a lot of conversation. I recall this to one day at Pocono. It was raining, about like today's temperature, and we sat in the car and we talking and so on, and Bud opened up about D-Day, you know, and so on, and I just don't know how a young man, and there was thousands of them that day that took the beach, how they had the courage to climb that wall and do their job, but Bud was one of them. He was one of them, and he was a great innovator in racing, too. I used to love to go to Spartanburg. In fact, we have some relation down there just south of Spartanburg, and I just told my wife, I said, you know, we're going to make that trip, but I get one day to go up and see Bud. yeah, terrific
good
man.
For you.
That's great. Ben, I think we got another phone call there. Let's bring it in.
Yeah, this is Clem Zorowski from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, when Ford went to Le Mans with the 427 cubic inch GT40s, and they used the four-shooter carburetors where they discharged everything into all four barrels at one time. Actually, it was two four-barrels. Was that a Ford idea, or was that a Holley carburetor idea, the four-shooter carburetor? Thank you very much. Bye.
Well, what occurred there was that Ford saw the need for the separation of primary to secondaries, and there was on the minds of everybody at that time, there was this vacuum mechanism that was going to do the job. And then it was Holley who came up with the clover leaf, you might say bell crank, that mechanically opened the secondaries. So I would have to credit Holley for that that cloverleaf bell crank for getting us into the right timing of the secondaries. And you couldn't trust the vacuum because it was before and after, and it just wouldn't. It all depends where the throttle plates were at the time you really wanted to see that there would be lags and so on. But one of the features of that cloverleaf bell crank was that it was so positive because it operated a roller-tipped lever, which, if you realize, would instantly open and pump the
accelerator pumps?
Yeah, the accelerator pumps, you know.
Hey, look, we've got more questions and the like, but we're running long now. I think it's time to probably wrap it up. Whoever called in from Hackensack, I got a little thing. You got a comment about the Viper, a question about the Viper. As Gary mentioned, we're going to have Ralph Jules here next week. He runs the whole Viper program.
SRT,
the whole SRT program is his, and of course runs all of design for Chrysler. So save your question for next week, because I think it's even more appropriate that we ask Ralph Jules about it.
It's Jonathan Brown.
Oh, it is Jonathan? So, okay, Jonathan, save the question for next week, and I only say that because we're running a little bit long right now. But Mo, so great having you back in. It's wonderful. Well,
thank you very much. It was great being here, and I always enjoy it either here or in front of my radio. Really.
That's great. Jim McCraw, great having you back here, too.
Thank you very much. Yeah. What a swell night this was.
Yeah, yeah.
Reminiscing about Ford racing. I could do this for a long, long time.
Thank you. Could. Yeah, you could, because there's so much to reminisce about. And Gary, good seeing you.
Thanks, John. That side of the room, boy, What a wealth of knowledge about this.
No
stuff.
Kidding.
So yeah.
We try.
That's great.
Yeah. Next week, and 200 in the studio. It'll be great.
We barely dipped into his library. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear some more that he's got to talk.
So I want to remind everybody before we go here, you can always listen to the show in the car as you commute. You know, you can get this through your smartphone. You can do it through Stitcher. You can use Bluetooth or an aux jack in your car. So just pointing that out, and I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.